So who am I?
Well,
and this is the start of the dog and pony show, I guess. Well, basically, nobody. Which is kind of a point. I don't have very specific skills. My blurb, you know, for the conference is a little bit more elaborate, but it doesn't mean much. You know, I've been one of those itinerant workers teaching at different places, and I've been playing with stuff, you know, because basically I live online. I do a lot of stuff online. Since 93, I've been very, very involved online, many different ways, from the very informal to the very formal, and you know, pretty much constantly. Even more so than many of my students, actually. I'm also a blogger, and which is a good opportunity to show to you that I actually posted the presentation of my blog. And I'm recording this, and I'll probably post the audio as well, if I get room somewhere. I don't have server space so much. But I've been pretty active as a blogger, only for 2 years, but including in the blogging community in Montreal that is called YoBlog. We have monthly meetings. Otherwise, I've been contacting bloggers elsewhere. Very interested in podcasting, which is related to blogging. I'm not doing it myself, but my courses are podcasted, and I will talk about that briefly. I'm pretty much a wannabe geek, because I can't call myself a geek. I don't have, I'm not a coder. There's something that's, I can't call myself a geek. Other people can call me a geek, that's fine, but, and I don't see it as an insult at all. I'm very fascinated by geek culture. I'm also a home brewer and a coffee geek, and all of that is connected. It's pretty male, West Coast, American, that kind of thing, and I'm very interested in that. I'm not trying to be like them. I'm also an artist and a musician, but I'm very connected to that culture, and I'm actually going to do actual research on geek culture pretty soon. But I have to set up all the ethics committees and such. And I tend to think out loud a lot, and what I'm doing today is pretty much that. So the presentation itself is just about thinking out loud, and I'll race through it. But there's one thing at the end that's kind of a radical idea, pretty simple idea though, but pretty radical at the same time. And it will be at the end, and then we can open with that. As we all know, we do live in fascinating times, and I'm kind of assuming that you've seen some of those videos. This one, did you know the shift happens? For instance, with all the data about people around the world and globalization, and the fact that bright people are exist everywhere, which we should know, the second one, that's, then we can watch them afterwards, but the second one, pay attention to the fact that nowadays our students are learning a lot of things online. Well, yeah, we know that, but so, it's important to think about that. And the third one, that was kind of the inspiration for my talk, is one made by an anthropologist who belongs to a group on open access anthropology, to which I also belong. And there's been a lot of buzz about this video. I don't know if you, who has seen that one? The machine is using it? Okay. I may show just a little bit of it. And it's pretty much, just a presentation with some annoying music in the background. But it's to talk about the fact that, our habits of thinking about text are not necessarily appropriate for the world in which we live. And by the end, he talks about that we'll need to rethink, because of Web 2.0, which is just the buzzword itself, but that because of that, we will need to rethink a number of things.
But it's interesting how he leaves out education.
How to
rethink copyright culture, rhetorics, but he leaves out education and learning, which is odd because he teaches at Kansas State University.
And this presentation was for an online version of the journal for visual anthropology, and he discussed a little bit what he was doing with that. And I want to rethink. And in my case, it is about learning, not necessarily education, but learning itself. And because my perspective is similar to his, you know, it's non-deterministic. It's not because of technology that we do that. We live in this time that it all connects together. It's this context, you know, this frame in which we live. The video itself got a lot of exposure to those ideas. And people criticized it and such. And I was more interested in the exposure that we got than in the video itself. I thought the video was interesting as a trigger, but you know, it mostly as what people did with it, that suddenly they were actually rethinking about, you know, rethinking a few things. I really like the fact that it, on purpose, he wants it to be reused in different contexts. It's very obvious, you know, it is open, can be translated, can be put to different music, hopefully. And it can be, you know, you can do whatever you want with it. And he, you know, he belongs to the Open Access Anthropology group, so, you know, he's really aware of those issues. And I you know, my focus is kind of like on authorship and identity and copyright as applied to learning materials. And Wes, who did this video, is talking about Web 2.0. Another way to describe Web 2.0 is the sixth internet culture. The first one was about academics. Well, actually, the first one was the military, the second one, academics, and so on. But the one culture in which we are now, you know, the period in which it's pretty prominent, is mostly about participation, you know, participatory culture. Well, okay, but then participating in, well, mostly in learning. That's, you know, people are sharing information, and that to me is pretty much what learning is about. And learning is in itself a creative process, and people share things, and they, you know, it is obviously a creative process, but of sharing things that they create, to me, it's exactly what learning is about. And people are constructing knowledge together. The name dropping that I do most commonly is the fact that my father was trained by Jean Piaget, and I'm pretty much a constructivist. You know, it's probably the reason I'm an anthropologist. Without knowing it, that's probably what influenced me the most, is that, yeah, I see knowledge as being constructive. Yeah, obviously, duh. And people, you know, the visible aspect, or the obvious aspect of this participatory culture, is that people are creating content, what people call content. And content has value, obviously. Well, okay, but part of that content is what I will call, for this presentation, learning material. What I mean by learning material is very broad. Everything that can be used in learning, which can be pretty much anything, including just things that are, you know, gathered, you put together for learning purposes, or material that's, you know, built for learning purposes. And then material that's created through a learning process, you know, that we build together because we want to learn how to build this. It counts, you know, it's learning material. And my emphasis is verbal in this case, and I think that a lot of what people do share, the information they share, is to a large extent verbal. Even those videos, those viral videos that I mentioned, you know, they're pretty much slideshows with music. The visual aspect is there, but at the same time, the impact of the visual is there, but the verbal emphasis is still, you know, there. We connect through verbal means. There are different types of material, and this is, you know, I'm just going to list a few types, you know, and subtypes. That's very, you know, broad, very simplistic. But just thinking about, you know, learning material in general, or material that we create in general, then material that's created by learners in learning situations, created by teachers in teaching situations, and then, you know, published material that we can use in learning context. So general material, well, you know, email messages count. We write a lot of email messages, and that content can be valuable. Same thing with forum posts, with blog entries, with comments on blogs. All of that counts. I mean, if you accumulate a lot of that, you know, it's a lot of knowledge that is shared, or at least information that is shared. Learner created, well, you know, course notes. When do you take notes? You know, it's so simple, but then, you know, they write a lot. It's keywords, but still, you know. Term papers, you know, and how can we turn them into something else and to be shared and whatever else, like portfolio and whatever else. But just thinking about the material that students create, that learners create. Presentations, you know, whatever mode they use, and even exam answers. I don't like exams because, you know, you can't do much with the answers afterwards, but essay exams, very often, I actually learn a lot through my students' essay answers.
And sometimes they're good for humor.
Yeah. teacher-generated content, well, there's a lot, of course. You know, we produce a lot of material. And it's, you know, from the very simple stuff, like a syllabus, you know, all the syllabi that we build, and we're perfectly okay with sharing them with colleagues. You know, I don't know anybody who's saying, oh, no, it's my syllabus, you know, you won't get it. You know, we're perfectly fine with sharing it. And we do that with a lot of things that we create, including slides, lesson plans, exam questions sometimes, but then, you know, we want to keep them very secret, obviously, for obvious reasons. Although I have built exam questions with students in the past and in this past semester, and I really like it. It's a very interesting process, and I will do it again. Especially at Concordia, it was a wonderful experience. And the lectures themselves are content that we create, you know, and supposedly it's what we're prepared for or something like that. Well, no, it's content that we create that has value. And then published content that we use, journal articles, monographs, textbooks, and all the reference material that we use. No, that's very obvious. But just thinking about what we create and what's the value of that and what does it mean to use it in different contexts. My own personal approach is very simple, simplistic almost. And I know that people who talk about e-learning or, you know, or things like that, I actually don't teach online classes yet. I actually want to, and I wanted to do it at UNB Fredericton. Didn't work out because the department took over saying, well, he's not really part of the department. He only taught for one semester, so we want to keep the course for ourselves. Okay. But still, you know, I use a lot of things online, but at the same time, very simple stuff. Stuff that I'm comfortable with. I do use forums and such, and I won't discuss that, but, you know, I have kind of a workflow that's adapted to the way I teach, and, you know, it's very simple. It's, I think about the stuff, and I rethink about my discipline. I choose a text, eventually a textbook, unfortunately, especially for introductory classes, for upper level classes, you know, the course back that I build, okay. Then from the text, I take notes, usually on my PDA. I take a lot of notes. Then I build outlines that will be one per lesson, per class meeting. Then I teach from those outlines, basically, you know. And then I get feedback from students in many, many ways, you know, during class, in exams, you know, what they've understood, what they didn't understand, what they post on the forums, you know, things like that. Which gets me to rethink, and then, you know, the following semester mostly, you know, I take, between the two semesters, I take a step back and I rethink and I use another text. So for an introductory class on cultural anthropology, I've used 4 or 5 different textbooks so far because none of them is really good. But at least, you know, I'm building on something. Now, the very simple thing, and I really like outlines. And they're so simple, they're nothing. But they're content, they're material that we use, and I use them to organize my thoughts. I tend to go on tangents, on very long tangents, and to be completely disorganized. I still get that on the student evaluations. You know, okay. Because I will get there, and somehow they will be exposed to something that they didn't think it was relevant, but then, you know, they have epiphany moment, and you know, it makes sense. I use my outlines as slides during lectures so that students know where I'm at. And very often, actually, students have told me, you don't need those slides. Okay, well, I need them to organize myself, and I might as well show them at the same time. I've been playing around with not showing them at all, showing only a few, only lecturing for a little, maybe 15 minutes. But still, I have that material that I show in class, and either I share it before class or after class as a lesson plan. The exact same content, the same outline. Very simple. I used to use OmniOutliner on macOS 10 and produce LaTeX files that were, the PDF slides and the PDF handouts that were the same outlines. Very easy, very simple, but a lot of content, actually. Simple content is not a lot of pages, but a lot of thoughts organized like that. It helped me to rethink about all the material. And then I was, students could use that as study guides, and students always ask me if I didn't post the lesson plans, in time for the exam, they always ask, well, where's this one for, lesson 12? Well, wait for it. You can use it as a study guide at one point. And I use it myself to remember what I taught, it just reminds me of what I did. In terms of podcasting, obviously it's content that I'm giving and that's produced by the university in this case. It's Concordia that records my lectures and puts them online as a podcast. And I wanted to do it myself, mostly because I'm teaching one course on the anthropology of music, and I thought, well, it's very obvious. I'll do a podcast about music and with the musical excerpts, and then the students can listen to it. But there are issues. And some of that music is licensed, but in different ways, and I didn't want to, Concordia didn't want to deal with that for very obvious reasons. I actually sent an email to the general counsel, who didn't answer, obviously. I thought, okay, well, I still record a lecture, and for myself, I distributed playlists on my blog, actually, so that students could go back to some of those excerpts. And what podcasting did, I didn't get a lot of feedback. I didn't do a survey with my class, but what it did is that because you can repeat the content, students had a different way, I perceived that they had a different way to observe the lecture, to sit at the lecture. That they knew that it was okay if they missed a part, they wanted to get the whole picture, and that they were engaging themselves as much as possible. I did get low attendance, but I always do, because I don't require attendance. And those students who were there, they weren't there because they would miss the content, they were there because they could then engage in the material, either by vocal participation or just, this is the right time to be in a stimulating environment and all of that. I'm not that concerned about attendance. Some people are. I hope my chair isn't. But the thing is, it really helped me to have this understanding that the course is about engaging concepts, not just, providing information. Information can be found in books. Well, okay. And I want to build upon the content that is podcast. I haven't listened to myself too much. It's kind of boring to do so, but what it sounds like,
I want you to make it more interactive.
It's pretty boring. Well, the thing is, though, you can put it as a Mickey Mouse voice, and listen to it faster, and you can go back and all of that. But I want to build upon this content. I won't reuse it as is, but I will listen to it again, because we don't remember everything that we teach. I improvise when I teach. And to basically, think, I taught that last year, did it work, did it not work? I have my own feedback about my own thing. Obviously, I could just record myself, which I do, but in this case, it's easy. I can be wherever and it's available. It's easy. And just as archiving, for archiving purposes, it's pretty interesting. So, my talks, well, th- this session is about what happens when we put material online. It's kind of obvious, and I want to talk about three characteristics of online material that I find very interesting. I'm very enthusiastic about online content as a whole, and obviously not every piece of content is free, open, and flexible, but I think those characteristics are pretty interesting, especially for learning environments. Well, free, as you know, I'm sure most of you know, by free, we usually mean free as in free speech, not free as in free beer. Well, I'm a home brewer, so I also care about free beer. And it is actually a point. I care about the fact that students have to pay a lot for a lot of the content that they need access to. But in free speech, free as in free speech or freedom of speech, to me, you know, as a Canadian, it sounds very American. I was listening to Richard Stallman just before I came in, and it sounds very American. You know, freedom of speech exists here, but we do take it for granted in a way. But if we talk about freedom of information, we have the Freedom of Information Bill and all of that. It makes sense. Freedom of information. Yeah, no, it makes sense. But it's the same concept. It's not necessarily free as gratis, but free as, you know, free, like free, freedom of speech, you know, liberty. Open, well, you know, openly accessible, but then also transparent. That, you know, as she was saying, not using passwords on some of the content. Well, you know, it makes it also more transparent. A lot of things that we do, you can see behind the scenes and see what's happening in the background. And it connects, obviously, with the freedom of information concept that, you know, it's very transparent, very open process. And it's boundless. It's open that it doesn't have clear limits. It's not like a book, which has clear limits, you know, page 1 to page 329, and then it's done. Well, you know, with online content, because it can change, you know, it's limitless. In a way, at least that's one way I see it. It's flexible because it can be timely. It can be updated as much as we want to update it. It's dynamic. It will change with time because of the way people access it in different ways. What people add to it, just links to content that is already available, transform the content itself. And it's pretty adaptive, you know, to different situations. You use the same content. You only need to change it a little bit sometimes, and right away it's adapted to a new context, the whole customization. What's kind of fun with online content is that students, well, you know, in learning situations, students can do a lot with it, including, you know, telling others, oh, check this out. And people do that. You know, they do that with books. They can say, oh, you know, look at my textbook, it's fun. But then the whole sharing and peer teaching. Basically, they will say, you know, they will tell a friend, you know, in my class, we saw this, and here's a link to it. Well, if it happens, I've done more than my job. It's not because of me, but, you know, it's very satisfying. And it gives us more exposure. Well, it gives people more exposure to our ideas. And that's something that's very important for people like anthropologists, because anthropology is not necessarily that well known by people, and we're not training people very specifically. We're not giving them information that will turn them into trained, specialists who will do some specific task. It's you know, skill transfer and all of that we want people to achieve. So we're perfectly fine with getting more exposure. And increase awareness of the discipline, of the material, of, you know, the learning processes that are involved. What's fun also is that we can repurpose it, you know, semester to semester, and grow the understanding. You know, in my abstract, I was thinking about shoulders of giants. Well, you know, we create our own giants on the shoulders of which we stand. So, you know, more and more, if we taught it last year, and, you know, for some reason, people this year actually understand that we don't need it anymore. We can move forward. You know, there's that. You know, teaching the same material over and over again, to me, is boring. And, you know, it doesn't grow understanding for the learners themselves, but even for science as a whole. And by repurposing year after year, we find new ways to teach them, and you know, students themselves find new ways to explain it to themselves and to each other. So do we still need textbooks? Which is kind of my rant part of that. You know, I have a number of textbooks. I'm actually reviewing this one for a person. And I'm being pretty critical. I actually don't think we need textbooks so much, but I still use them for a few reasons. I don't have all the material I need just right now. But there's so many problems with textbooks. And it's hard to keep up with all the editions of the same textbook, but also all of those textbooks, which are pretty much the same. The content, you contain the same chapters, you know, it's really funny as how are similar they are. Except, you know, I was really surprised just recently, I was sent a textbook, Thinking Like an Anthropologist, which is specifically not using the same structure. You're thinking, if you have so many different textbooks for the same type of class, why don't you change stuff a little bit, right? And the fact that they're static, you know, within the same edition, you know, you need to wait 2 years until it's updated to take into account that material is online, you know, the websites that they cite are never available. It's not true, but still, you know, it's not up to date and all of that. It's very costly to students. It contains a lot of unnecessary material, things that, you know, we don't use, but then, you know, oh, it's neat, it sells better, you know, there are neat pictures, but also just whole chapters that you could throw out. Oh, but then you can customize it and save a few pennies. Okay, but students will still complain that it's too expensive. And the expertise, in my experience, at least with cultural anthropology textbooks, the expertise is pretty inconsistent. They're very good at the core material, but then when you talk about linguistic anthropology, they always mess it up. I'm a linguistic anthropologist, and I look at that and no, this isn't accurate. So if you have a linguistic anthropologist who's doing the chapter on linguistic anthropology, there's something that can happen. And this is my simple, but I think radical idea. But very simple, creating material together. There are many advantages, and I'm thinking of online learning materials that are created by the community. Learners, teachers, you know, with colleagues, with students, even with, you know, authors, researchers, all of that. We're constructing knowledge together. We're collaborating, you know, it does encourage collaborative learning and active learning. It's pretty much collaborative editing. I was thinking of Wikibooks. There's Wikipedia, Wikimedia, but there's Wikibooks, that's pretty much, you know, collaborating on textbooks. And it does encourage critical thinking.
Have you seen George Stevens' new text, UN Knowledge? Because he did it in that manner.
Yeah, and it's actually available online as two PDFs. That's the kind of thing. In terms of critical thinking, just I'll just show you a website that I find very interesting. And I know that many people don't necessarily know about it. Obviously, the one that I learned about was for the anthropologist. So it's the virtual training suite of Intute, I-N-T-U-T-E. It's on my blog also. And there's a part about judging, you know, which websites are worth using. Well, they train you with discipline-specific tips to recognize, you know, appropriate information. It's not, oh, it's online, so it's bad, or it's online, so it's good. It's, well, let's learn how to judge information that you get with the tools that you have through your discipline, which I find very interesting. So, and then we get a diversity of voices. Even when there are multiple authors for the same textbook, you don't hear the voices. You know, when they say I, it's for a very specific anecdote that they have, but even then, you don't see the differences, different voices, they don't argue with each other. And you know, in terms of critical thinking, that could be a problem. You know, it sounds as if everyone agreed this up. And I really care about diversity of voices because I am an anthropologist. So I think, you know, it can fit, and students are perfectly fine with it. They can recognize it, at least when it's spelled out, you know, these are our different perspectives, this is me talking. You know, they do that in their papers. They're very good at it, actually, you know, to say, oh, this is my perspective, this is this other person's perspective. And, you know, they merge, but at the same time, they are still different.